Hello, and welcome to the Personal Wealth Coach. This episode, we're going to be talking about what happened in the week ending April 26th, 2024 in the market. We'll also talk about some amazing things like the GDP report that just came out, how inflation's running, what's going on in China, a little bit. There's too much there to cover in great length. Another failed bank. This is a big one. It's not a big bank, but it's a big subject because people are going to be worried about that. And that America's economy is strongly in the number one position on the planet and getting more so. Talk about that on the other side of the bumper music. Welcome back to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff
McClure. Together we are bald and we're here to talk about economics. We're also bearded and other strange things apply to us as well. We're doing this from across the country. The elder baldy, Jeff, is way out in the Smoky Mountains, and the younger baldy is sitting in Central Texas enjoying the humidity. So just saying, you go to spas and you pay a lot of money for that. So, you know, it might be worth coming to visit Central Texas in the middle of summer sometime. You could save money at the spa.
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to give myself a little bit of support. You're off in this beautiful, cool environment, mm-hmm. and I'm sweltering back here. Okay. So before we go any further, we're going to do the disclosures very quickly. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. That's also the name of the firm that the two of us run. It is an SEC-registered investment advisory firm, and just because it's registered with the SEC doesn't mean that we have any kind of specific expertise based on that. We have our expertise from other sources. We can't give investment advice on a podcast because we don't know everybody. This is an educational program. The data that we're going to talk about today comes from sources that we deem to be reliable, but we're not guaranteeing other people's work. Just not going to do it. There's been enough revisions to GDPs in the past that if we guaranteed it, we would be in a lot of trouble. Yeah. And that's it. That's our disclosures. That was fast. Woo. All right. So what happened this week in the market?
Well, if ever there was a week, as we start off in the newsletter saying, for the market to draw back on current news, it would have been this week. But instead, it went forward, which just shows you how perverse it is. There's an old saying, a bull market climbs a wall of worry. And it had a bunch of worry this week and went up, which is just strange. But that it does that. The SPX, the S&P 500 stock index, closed the week at 5,099.96, which sounds like somebody is pricing something.
5,099.96 at your local dealer. And that's cool.
Tax, that's title, license, dealer preparation fees, FOB Detroit.
Right. Got it. So it rose 2.76% for the week. It's still down about 2% for the last month, up 4.27% for the last 3 months, and up 6.92%, nearly 7% this calendar year, which is about, by the way, the total rise on average it has over the long term. And we've accomplished that in less than 4 months. So it's doing quite well. It's up over 22% from a year ago, which interestingly is 22% this year, 22% 3 years ago, too. And that's the way it has been for the last 6 months. All of the gain for the last 3 years have been in the last 1 year, which is the way the market typically works.
And I'll jump in there to get specific, because you're saying just over 22. For 1 year, the market, the SPX, is up 23.33%, but for 3 years, it's only up 21.81%. So more than all of the return in the last year is attributed to the last, or more than all of the return of the last 3 years came in this year.
That's the way it works.
There's some craziness there.
The other indicator we use, the CRSP U.S. Mid-Cap Value Index, which has a tendency to give us an idea of what's going on in the middle of the market, the main part of the market, closed the week at 2592.95. Now, that's up 1.18% for the week, which doesn't sound good when you compare it with the 2.67 that the SPX rose. But the SPX fell a lot more last week than the Mid-Cap Value Index. And that's one of the things that we've seen. The Mid-Cap Value Index tends to have less volatility, and at least over the long term, historically outperform the other indices. It hasn't recently, but we'll continue to watch. So it's up 1.18% for the week and 12.26% from a year ago. On the other side of the market, where debt is king, where bonds are traded, which is a very, very different market. The 10-year U.S. Treasury note ended the week yielding 4.67%, which most people just kind of blank out. What's the deal? 4.67. That doesn't mean anything to me. Actually, it means a lot. That's where mortgage rates are driven. That's where a lot of other things are driven off of the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield. Now, the rise in longer-term interest rates is not and is almost never dramatic. It never, you very rarely see a dramatic rise or fall like you do in the stock market. However, I use the term when I'm discussing this, the fable of the frog in the slowly heating pan of water. If you drop a frog in hot water, it jumps out. If you gradually heat the pan up, the frog doesn't notice and can die. The 10-year T-note was yielding 3.95% at the beginning of this year and is now yielding 4.62. That is a huge rise. 17% rise in yield so far this year. And the problem is, if you own a portfolio of bonds or you own a bond, and say you owned a treasury bond at the beginning of the year, as interest rates go up, your price, if you decide to sell that bond on the open market, goes down. And yes, you can hold it to maturity and get your dollars back. And I've heard that over and over and over again. But if inflation runs along at 3% for 10 years, the dollars you get back at maturity are not going to be worth what you put in. So it's a losing proposition when interest rates are rising to hold bonds. In the Wall Street Journal, Jason Zweig, or Zweig, I don't know how to pronounce his name correctly, writes a column, and I've noticed the same thing, but he's an authoritative person who publishes in the Wall Street Journal, so we can quote him.
But we can be self-authoritative. We can.
Yes, we can.
Choose to believe our own authority, yes.
Right. But he noted that long-term bond funds have lost nearly a third of their value over the past 3 years. Think about that just a minute. If the stock market had fallen one-third over a three-year period, it would be headlines everywhere. Instead, what I see among the pundits is it's a good time to buy bonds for the long term. If interest rates, which were not forecast in 2020 to rise like they have, continue to rise over the next 3 years, very frankly, if it rises at the same rate, which is not unreasonable, you would experience the same thing over the next 3 years. Be careful there. I think a lot of people, a lot of pundits, a lot of people who are discussing the market are assuming that what we've seen over the last decade or two is the norm. They have simply never been in a rising interest rate environment, and they can't believe it's going to continue to do so. As a matter of fact, I read several articles today, one of them in Morningstar, which is usually very well balanced, suggesting that you might want to buy bonds so when interest rates come back down to where they were, you'll make money. Folks, it is a powerful anomaly, strange, unusual event to have the low rates of interest we've seen over the last two decades. Very unusual in the history of the United States economy or anybody else's economy. And 3% has been our average over the very long term on inflation. And I kind of think we'll see that again in the future. So it is not a winning proposition.
I'm going to give you another kind of breathtaking number. In the last 3 years, the very depths of the interest rate cycle was in August of 2021. We got down even lower than that the year before that, August of 2020. The 10-year treasury was at 0.52%. It's up almost 800% from
yes.
there. And I don't hear it being talked about. That's when we talk about 3 years, it's up almost 300%. So when people talk about when Jason Zweig talks about a third of the principal value on paper disappearing, that's what we're talking about. The interest rate 3 years ago in August, so a little less than 3 years, was at 1.19%, and it's now at 4.67%. That's a massive difference, and it's much more normal today than it was back then, but people don't
yes.
really talk about that. Okay, so back to the market.
So you just don't hear about it. Matter of fact, I read and hear more people saying that you should be buying bonds, buy bonds to balance out your portfolio. It's a good idea to buy bonds. It makes me wonder who you're buying the bonds from and who is paying the people to say buying bonds.
I can tell you who. There's a lot of people selling bonds right now. And in order to sell, you have to have a buyer.
And so the buyers in short supply.
Yeah.
And buyers in short supply. So remember when you see commentary from people on a sponsored site, and as much as I like Morningstar, they have sponsors all over their sites, and you will see bond funds sponsored everywhere. Those folks are in a hurt. They are hurting for certain, and they would love to have you go out and buy some bond funds to buy some bonds, because there's a lot of people really want to get rid of their bonds right now. It's kind of like gold. And you see a lot of people telling you that you should buy gold. Note that it is them that you're buying the gold from in most cases. It's advertisements. And if you're buying the gold from them, that means they think it's a good idea to sell gold, or they wouldn't be paying to get you to buy it. Now just think about that for a moment. Anyway, the last thing in the market we have is the
oil.
WTI, West Texas Intermediate Crude Oil, WTI, which is a really crude number. It also is working its way upward. Now, it's not up as much as interest rates.
I have to say 17... this. I have to say this. It may be a crude number, but it's a very sweet crude number.
Well, it's intermediate.
Okay. All right. Go ahead. It's okay. Very, it's sweeter than bitter. That's all I'm saying.
Right. Got that. So it's 17, it's at $83.68 a barrel, which is pretty reasonable, but it's about 17% higher than the beginning of the year and about 12% higher than a year ago. Why? Has there been some critical shortage of oil somewhere? No. As a matter of fact, China is using less oil. Europe is using less oil. And the amount of oil that's been taken out of circulation due to the Ukrainian war has been less than the amount that there's been a drop in demand. So if demand falls and supply doesn't fall as fast, you would expect to see the price of oil fall. The reason it's not falling is because the United States economy is going harder and faster every month. And there's a greater and greater demand for oil. As a matter of fact, a big issue, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal about that today, I think, is that the demand for power, electric power in the United States, is rising substantially faster than the renewable energy sources are rising. As a result, between AI, Bitcoin, or crypto coin manufacture, and air conditioning, as the climate heats up, we're using a lot more electricity. As a result, the demand for petroleum is rising, and you can see it right there in the price.
And we can flip this a little bit. If talking about the ecology of the planet heating makes you upset, you can just flip it to the other side. A lot of places that didn't have air conditioning before now have air conditioning. So they're using it. It's one of those things that we do in Texas religiously, because otherwise you would melt.
You wouldn't go to church.
Right.
We do it religiously, and if they didn't air condition the churches,
nobody would go. Religiously, right. Wouldn't go. Right. So you've kind of nailed it there. The oil prices up. Exxon's profits are down. Why? Well, because they've started to limit how much oil they're putting out. They were flooding the market with oil. It's being asked for now. So there's some constraint being put by the manufacturers of oil on this. And that's why the prices are going up. But as I said last week, this is something people go, man, oil prices are going up. They have never been this high before. 15 years, 9 months ago. I can go even more specific. 15 years, 9 months, and 23 days ago, July 3rd, 2008, the price per barrel of oil was $145.29. That's not adjusted for inflation. That's just the price. If we adjust that for inflation, you're getting close to $200 a barrel based on this. And that is, as you might imagine, quite absurd. We're at $83.66. What's the difference? A lot of change in how we produce energy and how we use energy. Our fuel consumption is down because our cars run a lot longer than they did 16 years ago. The people driving today were born at a time when the price was $145 a barrel. And I think that's fascinating because it's a flip. People talk about how bad the oil prices are. It was maintaining above $100 a barrel from 2008 all the way through 2015. So just keep in mind, the fracking revolution changed a lot of things. It's really, really hard to complain about the price of oil for my generation. I know your generation, Elder Baldy, Jeff, and Dad, as a side note, those of you that don't know our relationship, is that he's my father, and he tells me about nickel gallon type stuff and how
No. 25 cents.
Five pennies, or at least like negative pennies, on and you had to walk barefoot to fill up your canister and then siphon it into your tank because they didn't have pumps.
I never saw 5 cents per gallon.
I'm just
playing. My grandfather probably did.
Right. So,
but it was routine to see 25 cents a gallon, particularly in the Central Texas area. 25 $25.9 was kind of the standard price per gallon of regular gasoline.
Right. Well, I remember back during the Great Recession as a formative time in my life, looking at the gas prices of being $5 a gallon and more. So just laying that out there. And I realize that we have just lost our video feed. So I'm going to put it back up in here while it's almost like being live again. And I have muted my mic on there so we don't get crazy.
Okay, me too.
Okay. So, all right. So something else happened at the end of this week that I think is kind of important. People have been talking about banks and are they safe yet? And we have a bank failure underway right now. It's been a slow motion molasses waiting experiment, but regulators are set to seize Philadelphia Bank Republic First. What is that? Well, it's a much smaller bank than the banks that failed when interest rates started up. But it almost failed then. It technically failed then. I have to tell people this because they're like, oh, another bank has failed. Well, it's really not another bank. It failed back then. The regulators were set to seize them and liquidate them and sell their assets when they made a deal with their investors to shore up their balance sheet. The problem is that the investors, when they realized how much of the assets of the bank were tied up in those really, really long-term bonds, they said no, and they got out. So since then, the regulators have been slowly approaching the point of we're going to seize you. They lined up a buyer for the bank months ago, and they've been slowly proceeding. So this is a lot less sudden and jolting than the bank failures that we had at the beginning of the rising of the interest rate cycle. But it's in essence one of the banks that failed then. It's not really a new bank failure. This is a bank that's been a zombie bank since then, where they're technically not capable of doing business, except that they've sort of been allowed to simply because they had a deal with their investors. So I wanted to bring that up because you're probably going to hear about that coming forward. Oh, we had another bank failure. In the newsletter, which was beautifully written, by the way, you talk about GDP and inflation. So do you want to take that one? This is a fantastic subject, and I think it's one of the best parts of the newsletter. But Jeff Elderbaldy wrote this in motion, didn't actually write it. You researched it in motion and then wrote it from the comfort of your beautiful RV. And I think it's one of the best ones you've done so far. So just heads up on that.
Well, there's something to really recognize, and that is when the gross domestic product is announced each quarter and there's a number put on it, it is an annualized number as if the whole year, and there's two things wrong with it. First off, it's just the first estimate. They're going to change it. Secondly, it's the number is an annualized number, which means we take 3 months and a good guess at 3 months and give that for the whole year. And people get excited. And the GDP that just came out was 1.6%, which sounds terrible. It isn't. It's really a very, 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 very good GDP.
Can you say very a few more times just to...
Very, 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 very good GDP. Why is it a good GDP? Because we look at inflation. Inflation, the Consumer Price Index came out earlier, and it was at, 3.4 for the year?
Yeah.
So if we've got 3.4% inflation, but the economy is only growing 1.6%.
3.7, I think. Something like that.
It was something like that. I can look it up. So we got this impression. It's very easy to get that impression that we're going backwards.
3.5%. I looked it up.
Okay. If inflation is growing at 3.5%, but the economy is only growing 1.6, man, we're going backwards. No, that isn't so. First off, when the GDP comes out, inflation has already been subtracted from it. But the inflation that's subtracted from it is not the CPI. Boy, does that sound crazy. It is crazy. The Consumer Price Index is based on a fixed weighting of things. One of the larger things it is based on is the theoretical rental value of a house that somebody owns.
That they're not renting.
That they're not renting out.
That they're actually living in, not renting out. Yeah.
And it is very slow to change, so it's generally considered less accurate, and the Federal Reserve doesn't pay a lot of attention to it. There's another one, that's from the Labor Department. From the Commerce Department, later in the month, in this case it was today, out comes the PCE Inflation Index. The PECX is the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Change Index. And that changes each month according to where people are spending their money. If you're spending more money on bread, then bread will get a heavier weight if the price of bread goes up. So it is a far more accurate measure. But here's the problem with the whole thing. I give you the news media jumps on the consumer price index or the PCE index for the last 12 months, looking backwards.
Mm-hmm.
But they take the GDP from just one quarter and project it forward.
And you compare the two. Yeah, it's just guesswork and hokum pokum to say this is the GDP for the coming year. You can't know that.
And they're completely different numbers, and they are projected in different directions. And they just, I really wish they would just give the quarter and say, okay, this quarter, this percent. Don't annualize it, but they've gotten the habit of doing it, so they're going to do it. If we, and then I went looking for, okay, what is the gross domestic product growth in the United States, not counting inflation, the nominal GDP growth in the United States over the last 12 months? I couldn't find it anywhere. So what I had to do is take the dollar amount of the gross domestic product of the United States a year ago at the end of the first quarter and at the end of the first quarter this year and figure how much it had grown. It's actually grown 5.4% in the last year. The United States economy's product, gross domestic product, has grown 5.4% in the last year, which is just tremendous. Now, that is from the Bureau of Economic Analysis and the Commerce Department. So let's stick with the BEA, and we subtract the PCE inflation, which the BEA calculates, from the gross. So we have had an inflation-adjusted gross domestic product growth rate over the last year of right at 2.45%, which is amazingly healthy.
That's right at the fastest expansion rate that we can do with the infrastructure that we have. We've been talking about this for years. This is that you can't really, the United States is not capable right now of growing faster than 2.5% a year because we can't fit any more trucks on the road. We can't fit any more trains on the tracks. We don't have the capability of packing more stuff on airplanes right now to get everywhere. So
it really, it is terribly misleading, and I don't know why it's misleading. I hesitate. I tend to not think it is a conspiracy by the government. Why do I think it's not a conspiracy by the government? Because I have been part of the government. Federal government. There isn't sufficient coordination and competency anywhere in the federal government to work up a conspiracy this large.
It's just bad calculations.
never see conspiracy when mere incompetence will do.
Oh, I have a new viewpoint on this. It's a philosophical item that I think I'll throw in here. I was getting frustrated because it seems like every time I get on the phone with any institution anywhere, I get frustrated because the thing that's running in my head is, why are people so stupid? And then eventually I was like, look, I can get mad at people for their ignorance, which will make me mad and will not improve their ignorance at all. It may actually magnify their ignorance. But if you think about it in a different way, ignorance is bliss. And if we have infinite ignorance in the world, we have infinite bliss in the world. So if we look at GDP as a measurement of infinite bliss, we can have a better feeling about the frustration of how poorly it's calculated. There we go. That's my very back-ended weird philosophy lesson for the day.
I had one other thing about markets that I just wanted to pitch out there. Copper hit $10,000 a ton this week. So what does that mean, people say? Copper is one of the more reliable predictors of global GDP over the next year. When copper is rising in price, particularly when it's rising rapidly, that means that around somewhere on the globe, somebody is using a lot of copper. And copper is used in almost everything we build, more and more so as we become more and more electronic and digital. It isn't China that's using more copper. It isn't Europe that's using more copper. It's us. And that is an indication that there's not unlikely to be a recession in the near future.
Now, I'm going to do a really quick statement about the yield curve. We've talked about it a lot in the past. The short-term rates on a yield curve. What is a yield curve? That's the interest rates that people are charged or are charging on loans. So if you have a loan for a very short period of time, you should rationally have a lower interest rate than if you have a loan for a long period of time. Why? Well, because whoever's loaning you the money isn't going to get to see it for a long time, so they want to get paid more for it. We have been in what's called an inverted yield curve for about 3 years. That means that the short-term stuff, the stuff that's supposed to be the lowest rates, have been the highest rates. And the long-term stuff that's supposed to be the highest rates have been the lowest rates. It's very backwards. We've been watching over the past 6 months or so as the curve has flattened. The longer-term yields are coming up to match, and it's a very strange look when you're used to looking at that. What does that mean? Why am I bringing it up? We expect that the Federal Reserve will eventually cut rates. They may raise rates before they do it, but the rates that they cut are the short-term rates, and it has very little impact on the long-term rates. So the yield curve looks like it is prepping to go to a healthy curve, which is fantastic. And why is that important? Because businesses usually grow on debt. And if they have, and most of the time they get their debt in the short term. So they say, I'll pay it back in 3 years or in 5 years. And right now those interest rates are high. So that's slowing down some of this growth. As those rates come down in the future, which presuming they do, the Federal Reserve says eventually they're going to cut rates. And if that's true and they actually do it, then we'll see more growth in small businesses as they take on cheaper loans and move forward. We'll also see more people making long-term loans. Why? There'll be more money available to make a mortgage loan because the mortgage rates are up near 7% these days. That's a pretty nice return on your loan investment. So we can see that going, reverting back to the long-term averages. Throughout the 20th century, the average mortgage rate was right around 7%. So we're back at the long-term average, not at the place where everybody should have been completely happy, but thought it was just the new normal. It's the way golden eras are, I think. Everyone thinks it's just the new normal until it goes away, and they go, oh man, those were the days. Well, we're living in those days for other stuff now, and the stock market being part of that. So the yield curve is flattening, and it looks like it's starting to fix itself. That's good news. And I only have two more quick subjects. Number one, I mentioned this in the lead up. The United States is by far on top of the world as the leading powerhouse. A lot of people will say, well, China's number two. Well, not really. The European Union, when you add the UK to it, is at about 20.5% of the GDP of the planet. The United States is at 26.3% and China's around 17%. Where is this coming from? Well, it's for the Wall Street Journal, but they're getting it from the International Monetary Fund. Where are they getting it? From the GDP reports of the very countries that we're talking about, from their governments. This includes China, who's been fudging their reports. But when you add it all up, China is still only about 17% of the world economy, where the United States is at 26.3%. What does that mean? Our GDP is growing significantly during the past year, while the European Union has been shrinking, and China has been, according to them, growing slower, but according to every outside economist that bothers to do some math, it looks like they've been shrinking too. So put that together and we're even higher up in the percentages than it looks like we are because some of the numbers are being fudged. So that's good news. Why is that good news? Because it's a representation of the success of our way of life, of our chaos and our messiness and our, you know, we've got so many problems in our system, and yet we continue to dominate the planet economically because in some ways chaos is a better way of growing than structure and order. Just ask Germany about that. I mean, think Germany is a fantastic place to live. It's a fantastic economy. They make very quality goods, and their GDP has been shrinking continually as a percentage of the world since 2006. They used to be about 27% of the world GDP, and they're now at about 20% of the world's GDP. Now, they've done well during that time. They had growth, just the rest of the world grew faster, where we've been growing at least as fast as the entirety of the world to keep our position at the top at 26%. We passed up Europe there. So that's just a little pep talk. Hey, we're doing it right. Keep doing it, guys and gals. And then the last tiny piece that I have, and it really is a tiny piece, but it's important. China's just announced a car purchase incentive to its citizens. They're offering the equivalent of about $1,200 to its citizens to replace old cars with newer cars. The first thing that's going to do is it's going to prop up the electric car market over there, which is failing quickly because they can't find people to buy their car. Their cars don't work very well. And the folks that are in Europe and the rest of the world look at it as being overly cheap, that the government is subsidizing it in China and flooding the market elsewhere. but the cars aren't working well. They're not safe. They have engine or motor problems. There's a lot of issues there. Well, China is offering this incentive, and it's the first thing that they've done that makes any sense economically coming out of the pandemic. Their central bank are still talking about not putting any money into the bond market there. Their real estate market is in horrible shape. That means that everybody that's given loans on that market's in horrible shape. And the central bank of China is just not doing anything about it. So having said that, this incentive to buy cars is something that could start to let them recover a bit, or it could just turn into a communist program and move them back several decades in time. So we'll have to wait and see. This week was just so packed full of news from one end to the other. We had a lot to talk about this week. Do you have anything else you want to bring up before we wrap it?
Oh, there's always more. There's always more. But this has been good. We've hit the high points. Just, it's a good idea to pay attention, be careful. And I guess the bottom line in investing right now is don't assume that what's been going on in the past 20 years is normal. Don't think we're going to get back to that. There's something completely different coming out of this, and it's going to continue to change.
And there's another thing you should never assume, that we two bald people are in any way normal. You should just absolutely never assume that.
That is absolutely correct.
And if you would like to talk to us weirdos off the air, we have voicemail during the weekend and real live people during the weekday locally at
254-947-1111.
Or you can reach us toll-free on a landline should you still have one of those ancient contraptions at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you can contact us there on our contact form. You can listen to the podcast there. You can also listen wherever you currently are listening. There's also a veritable morgue of old radio program recordings going back through the years. It's worth checking it out. You can read the newsletter there, sign up for it, and get it directly should you like. And until the next episode, thank you very much for listening. This has been The Personal Wealth Coach.